The Parents Show on Mix 92.6. Sponsored by Raiden Solicitors. Award-winning specialist family lawyers. See raidensolicitors.co.uk.
You're listening to The Parents Show on Hertfordshire's Mix 92.6. I'm Vivian Glass, and speaking to me for this evening's show is Paul Davis, the Academy Director of the Paul Davis Fencing Academy. As it's the UN's International Day of Sports for Development and Peace on Sunday, the 6th of April, I wanted to talk to Paul and learn more about this fencing academy in St Albans. Welcome to the show, Paul.
Hi, Vivian. It's lovely to be invited here.
Well, thank you for joining us. Paul, I mentioned there about this International Day of Sport and Development for Peace, and now I'm speaking to you about fencing, but I always think about this idea of sort of sword fighting and how this has really historical roots in the UK, particularly. Am I right? Is that something that you can tell us a little bit about the history of the sport?
Yeah, fencing has a very rich history from being the sport of kings, its journey from the battlefield to the state-of-the-art technology now at the Olympics and taking center stage at the Olympics is such an exciting journey. And it's one of those sports that's really captivating to the imagination. Everyone can picture themselves sword fighting, whether that's sticks in the back garden or Jedis out in galaxies far, far away. It's one of those wonderful combat sports that not only brings together the creativity and imagination of individuals, but also can hold very valuable life skills that prepare our community for the big world beyond the fencing beast.
Oh, fantastic, Paul. How on earth did you come into this? How did you come to be running a fencing academy?
So I got into the sport. I used to be part of the Pony Club. And so we used to do the tetraflon, which was swimming, shooting, running and horse riding. And I wanted to start the modern pentathlon, which included fencing as well. And I was very fortunate that I went to school in St Albans, Verulam School. And there was a very passionate fencer as a design technology teacher there who decided to give up his Monday nights to start fencing, and I jumped at the opportunity. But what was really interesting is after the first few weeks, I wasn't enjoying it. I wasn't finding my passion for it, but my mum said she'd paid, so I was doing the whole term. And I'm so glad that she did. Not only did it teach me about commitment and having to see things through, but it also gave me the time to see more about what the sport had to offer. And my love for the sport grew from there. And I went on to get bursaries to go to Newcastle University and fight for the university in Great Britain. And then I'd graduated. And when I came back and started my first master's, I decided to set up a fencing club back at Verulam School, where it started, but it stopped. And I got a sports grant, and I was very fortunate. The 948 Sports Foundation, based at OAs, they supported my idea of setting up a youth fencing club in St Albans, and they gave me £1,000. And I booked Verulam School canteen for 6 weeks, thinking that if it didn't work out, I'd be able to walk away from it and lessons learned. And so for those 6 weeks, I was sweeping up the remains of lunch off the floor to create this combat arena ready for our first 10 students. And that was in 2009. And fast forward 15 years, we're now teaching 1,200 children a week, 168 classes a week. And we have a huge team here. And we have our permanent base, the Hertfordshire Combat Centre, which I opened in 2020. So it's been an incredible journey. One from me finding out more about the sport, but in the main part, a big part about myself. And this is what we want to use fencing as a tool to help children find out more about themselves, whether they join us and they have a fire ignited within for a passion, or whether they say it's not for me. We're so happy that they've learned something, because we always say it's not just what you get, it's who you become. And in this world, it truly does matter. You will find that through combat sports, as like with other sports, your emotions will go up and down. Fencers when they're competing, parents when they're watching, you name it. And we do want to create environments where we make children sad. We want to create environments that make children frustrated, short-tempered, happy, elated. And then we want to teach them how to control it. Because what we say, the most important time in your life, Vivian, is the time between emotion and reaction. Because that determines who you are as a person. And on this topic of world peace, that is a big life lesson that many adults have forgotten as well, that their first emotion shouldn't be what triggers their first reaction. And it's that time in between that will really determine the world we live in as we grow up as well.
Well, it's powerful stuff, Paul. And I think, you know, you're so right that that reaction is defining, those defining moments. What age do children start fencing then? I mean, you're talking about these big emotions. That's really hard even for some of them as they grow older. But what age can they begin?
Yeah, so we start our school program from reception. So 4-year-olds, if you can imagine 4-year-olds sword in hand, all the way up to our senior team. We take everyone on their journey, and we have a big vision at the academy. It's a gold at the Brisbane Olympics in 2032. And we are going to have so many different people join us on part of that journey. But what we love most is that we're also going to be a big part of their journeys as well. Having the Fencing Academy going for 15 years now, there are still children who started with us in year three who are now finishing university and working for us and taking their fencing skills elsewhere. And that's the big wonderful part of it. We can start from day one, but we're going to be with you till day X, and that's yours to determine. We just want to be that community safe space that you can be part of.
Paul, I spent a long time when my child was four, telling him not to throw sticks around, put the stick down. And now here you are handing them not just sticks, but swords. How on earth does that work? Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so we want to use this incredible sport as a tool. And that tool is to, like I said earlier, to teach them about themselves. And that actually swords can be dangerous, of course, but if they're handled in the correct way and they follow the correct amount of focus and attention to it, it can be a fantastic tool as well. It's a bit like a hammer, right? A hammer can build and a hammer can destroy. It depends what you do with it. And with the sword, we can build and a sword can destroy. But for us, if we can build a little bit about yourselves, then that's a big part of it.
And is there a sort of pathway from, you know, that early, those first steps into fencing? What's the kind of journey within the club? What's the syllabus?
Yeah, thank you, Vivian. So in our schools, we run a program that we established called the Shield of Endeavour. And the Shield of Endeavour builds together the life skills alongside the fencing skills and experience and the competitive element of it as well. And then when you move into the academy, you join our pathway scheme. We have an academy pathway manager who's one of the only clubs in the UK that has a full-time pathway manager. And I set together this program that ensures that we give every child the platform in which to grow at their speed. We always say that, especially in an individual sport like this, don't look to your left and right and judge yourself on what people are doing in their lanes. Just see the journey that you've been on and where you've come from and where you're going to. And so for our Shield of Endeavour at school, there are termly gradings, but those gradings are specific to your attitude and behaviour, your skill and your experience. And it's more of a road map to where you're going to, rather than to say that you've one-upped someone alongside your class. It's about, yeah, you in your own journey, but ultimately it's got to be enlightened self-interest. And what I mean by enlightened self-interest is that we have a pledge. So for our four-year-olds, and this may reassure you about giving four-year-old swords, we have a pledge that always starts each class, and it's that we are little ninjas on big adventures. We'll always try and overcome our challenges. We'll always help others on our journey, and we'll always be respectful. And what we want to get from that, even from the age of four, that they will need to step outside their comfort zone at some stage and just try their utmost. We're not judging you on how well you do, but how hard you work at it. Helping others on your journey means that everyone has a destination, a vision of where they want to get to. But don't forget those that are on their journeys alongside you, because actually, a journey is more enjoyed when it's done with someone. And then lastly, to be respectful. And respectful is respecting yourself, because actually negative self-talk is one of the biggest challenges that we all face in this world. And then understanding how you can respect your coach, your peers, the equipment. And if we can bring all that together, they're the three main values that underpin our philosophy here at the Academy. And for 2025, our two main focus areas that I truly believe back those three parts of the pledge up are gratitude and accountability. being grateful for the opportunities you have and being accountable for the choices you make within those, because we are so fortunate within Hertfordshire. Actually, when I was driving down the M1 from Bedfordshire the other day, Hertfordshire is called the County of Opportunity. I don't know if all your listeners are aware of that, but what a wonderful county to be in, the County of Opportunity. And actually, we need to be very grateful for that. And we do need to be accountable for every choice we make. And they always say that people only see your decisions, they never see your choices. And actually, we do have so many choices that we make day in, day out. Myself as a company owner or a coach or a parent, it's those things. And kids have to, we have to create a safe space where children start to understand that as well, that they do have choices, and ultimately that will define who they are depending on which one they take.
You mentioned respect there as a really core value as well. And I think that's so important for creating this sense of community and working around that. Are the children competing individually? Do they work in teams? Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so the joy of fencing is it is an individual and a team sport. Even at the Olympics, you can fight the individual event, obviously one-on-one combat. And then in the team events, it's a team relay of three people plus a reserve. And so we find that this sport does capture those who are potentially on the fringe of curriculum sport at school, those who may not find the big team sports something that they can easily engage with. And once you put your mask on with sword fighting, you can be who you want under that mask. And this allows those to potentially those who may not be comfortable within themselves yet to be whoever they want to be. And that element of letting the creativity and imagination flow goes with it. But being a team sport with that as well is the beauty of it, that it has to be very tactical in team matches. Even though you are working collectively, each individual has a part to play in the fights. And we're really proud that at the academy over the last few years, the under 17 Great Britain teams have been built mainly from the academy fencers. And we've actually got four fencers heading off to the World Championships next week in China. And they've recently just come back from the European Championships as well. So we look forward to seeing how those fencers do at the under 17s and under 20s.
Oh, that's really exciting, Paul. Well, our very best wishes for a successful journey for them. How exciting for them to take part in that. What personal qualities, Paul, do you see as important for a great fencer?
Absolutely. So there's one of the biggest things you'll need is the willingness to come back. And what I mean by that, Vivian, is that not every single day is going to be sunshine and rainbows. And actually, when you feel in your darkest, those darkest days, and you're feeling a bit buried, potentially you're being planted. And that is an opportunity for you to go again. And the willingness to stand back up after a tough fight and to still shake hands with your opponent, dust yourself off, and then be back in training on Monday will be a life skill that you'll need to carry for every moment in life. And that's so valuable. Another one is adaptability. Adaptability, adaptive intelligence is key, not just for being in the fight, but for kind of rolling with the hits in life as well. And so, yeah, so the resilience part, the adaptability, creativity is really key. They always say if you don't follow a picture of the future, you're always going to be controlled by your decisions of the past. So you need to be able to see a vision of where you want to head to. Otherwise, you can potentially end up just wandering a bit lost in life. And then the last one is discipline. Discipline is so important. Self-discipline will support you through your whole life. I'm actually quite a disorganized person. And so it takes a lot for me to keep everything in place, and having a fantastic team to support with that as well. And discipline, I believe, is three areas. It's the ability to prioritize. It's the ability to say no to those voices that may be allowing you to cut corners. And it's the ability to not complain. And that is where discipline comes from, because everyone's going to have struggles in life, and everyone can justify why their struggles are worse. But sometimes you do need to get on with it. But also getting on with it, knowing that you do have a community around you that can put an arm around you when you need that as well. It's not purely just the kind of shoulders back, head up and march on, but knowing that you have people to turn to when sometimes it's not feeling that great as well. And that's the beauty that we have here at the academy. We have over 1200 members, and on Saturday, they may be fighting against each other to be crowned national champions. Monday, they're back working with each other again. And it takes a lot to build relationships that can be mature enough to see when their mask on, it's an opponent. When their mask off, they're teammates.
And in terms of physical accessibility, you know, how accessible is this sport for everyone?
Yeah, it is a sport for all. Actually, as soon as we finish this interview, I've got a wheelchair fencing lesson, and we offer wheelchair fencing here at the academy. But from seated fencing all the way through, from irrelevant of age, irrelevant of gender, irrelevant of physical abilities, as long as you're willing to apply yourself, you will get something out of it. We go into care homes and do seated fencing with the residents there. We go to, all sorts of places, and we set up a project called the Knight Academy that worked with local charities. So we worked with Afghan refugees in hotels in Watford. We work with orphans and stuff over holiday camps and help them there as well. And that the Knight Academy was about bringing my journey through the modern pentathlon, which is all about a French knight taking a message back from the battlefield to his kingdom. And we run the Knight Academy like that. So there's obstacle courses, there's building castles, there's learning sword fight, there's making shields and learning about your own family trees and crests. And it just brings it all together in a real educational way for these children as well.
Well, that sounds fantastic, Paul. And you mentioned there about shaking hands and the knights. Is there a great deal of etiquette involved in this sport?
Yeah, for sure, Vivian. It's with all combat sports, and I believe in life, it has to be rooted in that. Where, as I was saying earlier, the gratitude and accountability, like, you must salute at the start of a fight. You must salute and shake hands at the end. And that salute is also to the referee, to the spectators, to the coaches. Acknowledging them, like I said earlier, the enlightened self-interest, that your best asset in learning a sport is your opponent. They give you the desire to work harder. They give you the desire to get up in the morning. They give you the desire to go back and try again. And so everyone needs a good rival. And this is just as important. And acknowledging what your opponents have to do to be at that standard as well is where I believe that respect is rooted into.
And in terms of equipment, if I want to come and join fencing, what am I going to need? Or what would my
First
child
of all, you should come and join fencing. So should all your listeners.
It's been so exciting. You've really got
Hertfordshire, Hertfordshire Combat Centre on Campfield Road. We are here for you. Fencing equipment, as with a lot of sports, there can be an investment. But we want to remove the barriers that would prohibit people from doing that. And so for a good amount of time, we would be providing all the equipment, the mask, the saber, the glove, jackets, plastrons, breeches, body wires, lames, you name it. There's a good collection of stuff that we'll provide. And then we also have a shop at the combat center called the Warrior Wardrobe, where we can provide all the equipment then that you and your families and friends would need to get involved with the sport. So we are a one-stop shop. We'll get you in, we'll get you going, we'll get you inspired, engaged, empowered, kitted up, ready for battle.
Oh, it sounds fantastic, Paul. And you mentioned some of the things that you've got. So you've got your eye on these competitions that are coming up. You've got your eye on the Olympics. Just run that through us again. What's next for PDFE?
Yeah, so our big vision, 2032, it's written across the walls here at the Combat Centre, is gold at the Brisbane Olympics. We then work backwards from that. And we've actually, on our display screen downstairs, have a day countdown for the Brisbane Olympics, and it's just over 2,600 days. But in between that, we have a very busy period of time, everything tapering towards that end goal. For children, however, the prospect of looking a year, 7 years in advance is just beyond comprehension, and actually looking towards the weekend or Wednesday is long enough for them. So through our academy pathway, we break down our seasons into two phases. And so the first phase is a pre-season in July up to the qualification standards for European and World Championships in December. And then the second phase is then what we call the major championship phase. So they have another pre-season in December ready to culminate at the end of April, June time. and then it restarts all over again. And if we break it down that way, there's 14 phases now to the Brisbane Olympics. And within those phases, we have training blocks. And those training blocks are broken down into the physical training and also the mental training, because we understand that we know what's coming. The children may not necessarily know. So in preparation for the qualifications, we know that some people are going to have the best news. And we know that some people are going to have what they'd set their goal on for that year not met. And so we need to ensure that the life skills we give proceed in that period of time, prepare them for that. Know that we are that support network, that safety net around them, that when the news comes that isn't what they were hoping for, we can be there to prepare them mentally and physically for that. And letting them know that results at youth and under 20 age is not the defining factor of their lives. And actually, regardless of the results, it's like we say, it's who you become on that journey. And so we plan our seasons working to culminate in these areas, but ultimately the journey is ongoing as long as the athlete's willing to keep working on themselves.
And what if somebody shows a lot of promise, Paul, but maybe they're a little bit disadvantaged, you know, maybe the economics don't quite work for them? Is there pathways that are available for people that are needing that helping hand?
So our academy, we have what's called the Fighting Chance Fund. And each year I personally fund £25,000 to help people in our community, whether that's children who can't afford their school memberships, whether that's children who need equipment for specific events, whether that's children who need support traveling to international competitions. It's purely based on the application process. So we take everyone, no matter how much they are fencing, we take everyone on their application value. And where possible, we, like I said, we want to remove all barriers to the sport. I love the sport because I used to be a very shy and very timid kid. And through the sport and through the opportunities I've had setting up the academy, I've learned a lot about myself. And actually, it's what I want ultimately to give back to the community as well. So yeah, there can be a lot of struggles. And actually, we say in life, it's rather than always setting goals for yourself, it's also acknowledging which struggles are you willing to accept. And what we don't want is to create situations where things come to one of the pet words that I don't enjoy using is the word easy. It means without effort. And actually, we don't want that at all. And actually, if we can support some families, but see that they're willing to work hard with that support as well, not that they'll take it for granted that they're going to get a free ticket, then that's a big part of it as well. We want to see that commitment from the fencer as well.
So you can either come to the fencing club and you can join there and have lessons, but you mentioned you go out to schools and you have a program that's specific to schools. How many schools in the area, Paul, are you working in?
Yeah, so we currently work in 45 schools. We're taking on another 4 schools in the summer as well. And we have a team of coaches, about 13 coaches who go out and then deliver our school program from breakfast club all the way to the evening school sessions, and then all culminating back at the academy as well. So it expands throughout Hertfordshire into North London and Bedfordshire. And we're always looking to take on more schools. So for any governors out there, for any teachers, for anyone, head teachers that want to get fencing into their schools, please do reach out to us.
And lastly, Paul, can you give us your 3 things to take away that our listeners should know about the sport of fencing?
It's for you, and you is everyone. It's going to have to be about not just what you get, it's who you become. And who are you willing to become on this journey? Come with me and discover your inner warrior. We always say we want to celebrate that warrior within, the warrior who dares to be different and put on their mask, sword in hand, ready for battle. We want to celebrate that person who, when stuck, can find their way out, who, when down, can pick themselves up, who can keep going when others are done, because it's not just what you get, it's who you become.
Fantastic. For people who want to find out more, I'm certainly inspired, Paul. How do we find out more? Can you give us your website, any other social media information?
Yep, in person, Hertfordshire Combat Centre, online, Team PDFA, Paul Davis Fencing Academy on Facebook, Instagram, all the socials. Our website is teampdfa.co.uk, or just Google Paul Davis Fencing Academy, Google Hertfordshire Combat Centre, And yeah, you'll see our vans driving around St Albans, I'm sure. And anyone in the blue tops, obviously we're on radio, but yeah, anyone in these blue Adidas tops with fencing coach on the back would be very willing to help. So stop and say hi to us where you see us.
Oh, fantastic. Well, Paul, I know you've got this lesson, this wheelchair fencing lesson that you're due for very soon. So I really appreciate you joining us and sharing what an inspirational sport and something that sounds so exciting and so much fun as well for children and adults, actually.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you, Vivian, for having me.
Thanks, Paul.
So we're going to take a little break on the Parents Show on Mix 92.6. We'll be back with more chat in just a few minutes, so stay tuned.
The Parents Show on Mix 92.6, sponsored by Raiden Solicitors, award-winning specialist family lawyers. See raidensolicitors.co.uk.
So welcome back to the Parents Show on Mix 92.6. It's great to have you with us again.
You're listening to the Parents Show with Vivian Glass. This evening, I want to talk again about pets. Now, I know that many of our listeners enjoy owning pets, and we're not alone. In the UK, apparently 17.2 million households, or 60% of us in the UK, own a non-aquatic pet. A survey commissioned by UK Pet Food found that 36% of households own a dog, 29% own a cat. There are 1 million pet rabbits, 700,000 guinea pigs, 700,000 horses, and 600,000 hamsters. Now, of course, we know that owning a pet can really help with companionship, might be a source of comfort. And for children, it can help them perhaps develop compassion or caring responsibilities. But the downside of owning a pet has to be, in no small part, that they have much shorter lifespans than humans. This evening, we're going to be talking about how to handle those emotions among adults, and particularly among children, when it reaches that point and we're at the end of our pet's life. This evening's show discusses some sensitive topics, including pet loss. Listener discretion is advised. If you're affected by the topics discussed, there will be some information and points of contact shared at the end of the show. Joining me to discuss the topic of pet loss today is Annalisa, the Pet Loss Support Manager from the Blue Cross. Welcome to the show, Annalisa.
Hi. Hi, everyone.
Thanks for joining us, Annalisa. And we're talking, obviously, about quite a sensitive topic. We have already advised that some listener discretion is advisable here for this topic. But what we really want to talk about today, Annalisa, is the services that the Blue Cross can provide in the event that somebody finds they've come to the end of their pet's life, or they're facing some tough decisions around that, or helping to perhaps support children or family members in the loss of a pet.
Yeah, it's so hard, isn't it? When we have pets, unfortunately, they don't live as long as us. So we are unfortunately going to experience loss when we have a pet in the first place. And we're here to offer support for any type of loss. So you might lose a pet, not just through the death of a pet or euthanasia. It might be that you need to rehome your animal, or it gets stolen or strays. And we're here for that. All of that support. And we offer a helpline. We're open every day of the year from 8:30 to 8:30. And we can talk to the whole family. And we have our telephone line, a web chat, a service, and an email service. And just because it might be a really big thing to pick up the phone, especially when you're upset, not sure what to say, not sure how the person's going to react, whereas web chat is a little bit more anonymous, or sending that email, it gives you a bit more time to think about what you want to write. So we offer all those services to suit each person's way of communicating.
You mentioned, Annalisa, there are lots of different scenarios, pet loss not necessarily being at the end of life, but also, you know, a pet perhaps who's escaped or who's become lost, or different services like that. From a practical point of view, are there pieces of advice or resources that you're also able to direct people to when they call?
Yeah, so on our website, so our Blue Cross website, we have lots of literature, leaflets about how to, maybe things you can do to remember your pet, or how to talk to your children, or so lots of really good information on our website.
talking to children, that's a really tough one because obviously the whole family could be experiencing this loss very deeply. And we have emotional connections with our pets usually. And if someone's feeling a bit overwhelmed themselves, are there ways that you can support that conversation perhaps with the children?
So we often have families maybe contact us or parents that contact us not sure how to broach the subject of maybe their animal getting older or that loss of that pet. So we can be that listening ear and help you support you to be able to have those conversations. But, you know, as we know, depending on the children's age and their experiences, it might be their first experience of pet loss. So it's really important for their development to handle it the right way. And so it's about being really open and honest and having those conversations, even if they're really quite hard.
What could somebody expect when they first contact you? What would be the first, I suppose you must hear from people who are very distressed at times, yeah. But what could somebody expect if they reach out to you?
So we are a listening ear. We're not a counselling service. We're there to listen. Losing a pet can feel really lonely, especially if you don't have anyone around you that's maybe experienced pet loss. It can feel really isolating. So to know someone who really understands, so everyone who is on our support line are volunteers, and they've all experienced pet loss. So they really do understand how you're feeling, and they're there to listen and make you feel less alone.
You're right. I think there's so many people who rely perhaps on pets for companionship as well. And that must be a really difficult situation when that connection's gone, or perhaps it's somebody who relies on that social or that motivation to just go outside some days. You know, maybe somebody goes for a run in the morning with their dog before work, and that's been something that perhaps in a stressful job has been a real point of connection and something that they've become dependent on. There are so many different ways that we benefit, I suppose, from having pets. But if somebody feels that they really want to get some advice, what's the sort of advice that you might be able to direct them to, given that you've said it's not counselling?
Yeah, so it's about listening. We all experience grief differently. You know, there's lots of different stages of grief. So, for example, it might be denial that you're not ready to experience that loss. So, you know, you're maybe not wanting to take in that your animal's getting older or maybe had a terminal illness. So, you're not ready to take on those experiences, or you might be angry, or you might not know what you experience. It's especially children, it might be their first experience of loss. So all of these new emotions, they're not sure if it's normal to feel like that. So we're there to listen, normalize those feelings, validate those feelings, and make people feel that it's okay to go through those experiences, and they're not alone, and they're not being silly, or it's not unusual that they might be experiencing all those you know, maybe new emotions if it's their first loss.
I think one of the very difficult things that I've certainly heard from people who have come to the point where their pet may be very unwell and they're having to face a tough choice between really do they manage that illness and how can they manage it versus is it time to say goodbye to the pet. Can you help with that situation, and what sort of support could they expect in that scenario?
So it's thinking about that animal's quality of life. We would recommend that they go and talk to their vets, get their advice, because obviously we're only hearing a snapshot of what that person's going through, and we don't know the whole prognosis of that animal's pet. So we'd encourage them to talk to their vet, talk through their options, look at sort of quality of life, what quality of life means for them. And that euthanasia might be the kindest option. It might be the treatment option that puts your animal out of pain. It's really hard, isn't it? Because we're ultimately responsible for our pets. We're making that decision to put that animal to sleep. So it's really common in pet loss is to feel guilt, really guilty about making those decisions. Have I made it at the right time? Did I do enough? You know, did I do it too soon or too late? And it's really, really common in pet loss for that guilty feeling. And that is really normal. And actually validating that person's feelings is really important, and allowing them to maybe talk through the options with someone that is maybe not involved in the situation, is very non-judgmental, and can allow that person to talk through all the options and come up with their own decision. Because as I said earlier, guilt is a big part. So if I told someone, oh, I think you should put your animal to sleep, you might blame me. that I encourage you that it's it may be the right time, but actually giving you that time and space to be able to talk through your feelings, talk through your options, so you can make the best decision you can with the information you have.
And do you ever have a situation where there's a bit of conflict, for example, in around that decision, where perhaps one half of the family is in support of it and the other half isn't? Is there any kind of conversations you can have to get them to discuss it perhaps a bit more effectively?
It's about being open and honest. And children may feel like they're out of control, you know, especially if they're not involved in those decision-making processes. They might feel like, you know, they don't know what to do. So actually involving those in those conversations and looking at quality of life, it might be just putting it on the calendar, the good days and the bad days, because you might be focusing on the good days and not realizing that there are more bad days than good days. So that is a really good way to be able to see if that quality of life is deteriorating, you know, or looking at pictures, taking videos. So you've got something, you know, something to see and something to compare against, because actually when you spend every day with that animal, you might not notice that the downhill of that pet, and talking to the vet, talking to the professionals around you, getting support from maybe other family members and coming to that decision together. I suppose that we get more people contacting us after the pet's gone about whether it's the right time to get a new pet. That's almost a more difficult conversation, because some people might want to get a new animal straight away. You know, they want to fill that hole in their lives, but others they're not ready to give that love to another animal. They're still processing their grief. So that's sometimes a more of a conversation that we have with people contacting us, because we're all different. And it's really about having that open and honest conversation with your family about why you're feeling that way, so people can understand, you know, the differences.
And you mentioned there, obviously, that desire, I suppose, to have another pet. But I'm thinking, I mean, in my household, we have various pets. And, you know, if you've got bonded pairs, for example, of a pet, or you've got the pets themselves have relationships, is that something that you have practical advice on, ways to just check and manage how the other pets are coping, whether they're showing any, you know, signs of withdrawal or stopped eating, anything like that you can help with too?
Yeah, so animals do grieve for their friends, you know, they have those relationships, and they can also go through a grieving cycle. We have information on our website about grieving pets, so that can help you support, you know, how you can notice that. But then we'd encourage you, maybe if it is affecting them for a longer period of time, maybe talk to your vet and get some advice or some behavioral advice to be able to support your animal in the right way. But it depends on, you know, what kind of animal, you know, it is. So dogs are very sociable, so it might be getting a younger pet if that's right for your family, or, you know, or cats can be quite solitary animals, so, you know, introducing a new animal might be more tricky.
I guess as well, it depends, as you say, on the species, and then also the interspecies that you're going to bring in. You know, if you're going to bring in a different type of pet, for example, perhaps from the ones that you lost. And Annalisa, you know, we mentioned that there are other aspects of pet loss aside from the end of life. When a pet runs away or is lost for another reason, what can you advise when that situation arises?
It's really tough, because you don't, with that kind of loss, there's no closure. And, you know, how long do you wait for maybe that animal to return? You see stories in the news, don't you, of 10 years later, the cat coming back or the dogs being reunited. But, you know, it's being realistic. Obviously, after, you know, there's lots of things that, you know, you can do if your animal is lost or stolen, you know, putting posters up, putting stuff on social media. But then it's validating those feelings. It can feel sometimes worse than a death of a pet, because, as I said, you don't have that closure, but you can still do those same things that you might want to do once that, you know, your animal has died, is things like you can do memorials, have a memory box where you can put all of those memories of that animal, so you've got somewhere that's safe to go and to remember that animal, or, you know, or do a, you know, plant a tree or something like that, like you do for a death of a pet. It could be that will help with the closure a little bit, but it's that yearning of not knowing, it can be really difficult. And if it is affecting you, you know, on a longer period of time, we would suggest people to go in and get some extra support. Maybe if that's, you know, going to their doctors or getting some extra support out there. But we're, you know, we're here to listen and make people feel less alone.
I think that's really important. And I know, I mean, certainly cats are known for being quite fickle and sometimes take themselves off, I believe, to other households or, you know, just and then maybe return. But what's the sort of time period that you would say, for example, for a cat, you know, if your cat has been missing for a day or two, when would you start to think, hang on, this is actually very different?
That's really difficult to answer because your cat might go, you know, be one of those that, you know, regularly it's 2 or 3 days that he or her will disappear for and then come back. But it's really hard because you don't know. So it is personal to each person. And when they feel ready, you know, that they felt like they've done everything they can to maybe find that animal. It is really individual. So, I can't put a time scale on that because grieving, you know, when we grieve an animal, it's not, or, you know, a loved one or whatever we're grieving, it's not, there's no time scale to that. It's we learn to live with it. We'll always love that animal. We'll always love that loss. But it's learning to live around that grief.
I think that's an important fact as well to register and to think about. And how can you think about that? You know, if somebody is really feeling perhaps that they're quite overwhelmed potentially and they feel very stuck, is there anything that they could do as just one first immediate step that would perhaps release them of that in some way?
Contact us on our support service and have someone there to listen to how you're feeling, validate those feelings. And as I said earlier, it feels really lonely in that loss. So actually, you know, if you're lucky enough to have friends and family that do understand, talk to them because they might be feeling the same as you, but are too scared or don't want to burden you with their feelings. But actually sharing those stories can really help you through that.
And for those that perhaps don't want to phone, you mentioned that there's a web chat. That's a real person that you're chatting with. This isn't a robot that you're discussing your very inner feelings with.
Yeah. So our web chat and our email services. Web chat is sort of instant messaging. So there's someone there at the end. You're having that conversation. You know, I think some people feel it's more comfortable because maybe that's the way they communicate, because lots of us don't pick up the phone anymore. We use text, don't we, or other forms of media. So actually putting that message through web chat can be useful, or our email service, which is a little bit different to our other service because you have the same person who you're supporting. We have some people who email us once and, you know, they send us a long email and they've got everything, you know, put their feelings onto paper, and that's also a good way of processing those thoughts. But you have that ongoing support, you know, and you can contact us many times as you like. We have some emailers that have been emailing us for a year or longer and calling us regularly. So it is really depends on the individual. We also have a Facebook page, which is a closed Facebook community, which is nearly over 26,000 members. And it's just a really safe space to share your stories, because as I said, it can feel really lonely and you're the only one experiencing it. Whereas it's a really safe place to maybe share pictures or share your experiences and get support from others that are going through exactly the same as you are.
And one of the other aspects you mentioned is that sometimes people have to give their pets up. But I suppose when families break apart, sometimes that's part of the consideration, is who's going to get the pet and then who's deprived of that pet experience as well. Is that something that you come across often?
Yeah, that's really difficult. And rehoming for financial reasons, and people are often very judgmental about that, because how can you give up your pet? How can you lose that? But actually, they don't. You know, you've got other circumstances around that, and you can go through all of those emotions the same as a death of a pet when you're rehoming that animal. You know, feeling guilty that you can't keep that animal, or you know, for financial reasons or circumstantial reasons or whatever that, as I said, it goes unrecognized, and it again feeling really lonely and judged. People are very judgmental about rehoming, and we understand that it is sometimes, you know, the only option, the best option for the humans as well as the animals. So it is having that same support as a death of an animal.
It sounds like such a well-considered and well-resourced helpline. How do you find the volunteers, Annalisa, that provide this support?
They're so amazing. Like, we couldn't offer the service if we didn't have our amazing volunteers. They go through quite intense training. So we ask for 4 to 6 hour commitment a week to be able to do the training. It goes through things like active listening skills, how to you know, support someone, sort of euthanasia processes, what experiences people may come to you. We do have other links with like the guide dogs, so we might have calls with assistance dogs as well that, you know, are retiring or the death. So it's quite intense, and then they have to do practice calls and chats and emails depending on what service they're doing. So they're really prepared before they go live. And we ask for a 3 hour commitment a week. Some people do a lot more, other people do less, but we need each and every one of those people to have that continuity of the helpline. Obviously, I said earlier, we're open every day of the year from 8:30 to 8:30. So that's Christmas Day, bank holidays, all of those days where sometimes they're the days that you miss your pets the most, because, you know, with the celebrations and everyone else is happy, whereas all you're thinking about is that you want your animal back. So we're here for all of those days. And our volunteers are amazing, and I'm so proud to be part of the service.
And how many volunteers do you have, Annalisa?
So we have nearly 500 volunteers. So some of them are going through their training. Some of them are fully trained to be on the line. And there's lots of other things they get involved with. So they help us train new volunteers. We have a mentoring scheme. So there's lots of other things that our volunteers get involved with. They're so passionate about the service. Obviously, they've all experienced pet loss and know how difficult it is. So know how important the service is for people going through that grief.
And it sounds like they're a really wonderful group of people that you've managed to galvanise and mobilise into supporting others. If somebody wants to reach out, Annalisa, how can they find you?
So if you go to our website, so the Blue Cross website, and look for pet loss support, we've got all of the information of there of how you can contact us. We've got all the leaflets that I've talked about. So, you know, how to talk to maybe your children and your experiences yourself about grieving pets. You can download them, or we can send you out physical leaflets if you prefer. All of our information is on our Blue Cross website.
Well, thank you so much, Annalisa. I think it sounds like you're providing a really valuable service to many people. I know from being a pet owner myself, you know, it's one of the toughest aspects of pet ownership. And knowing that there's somebody who you can reach out to and just non-judgmental, listening ear, and be able to maybe provide that extra reassurance or that moment of comfort and give you a chance to process things in a really helpful way sounds so important.
Thank you. And thank you for talking to me today. And, you know, it's great that I can share the story of how we support people and our amazing volunteers.
And just, can you give our listeners just one more time, how do they make initial contact with your website?
So if you go onto the Blue Cross website and go to Pet Loss Support, all of our information's on there. So the telephone number to contact us, the icon to do web chat, the email address to contact us for email, and the link to our Facebook page. So if you go to the Blue Cross website, all of our information is on there.
Super. Thank you for explaining that to us today, Annalisa.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
The Parents Show on Mix 92.6, sponsored by Raiden Solicitors, award-winning specialist family lawyers. See raidensolicitors.co.uk.